Welcome to Modern Sign Books on Blog Talk Radio. If you're interested in what makes your favorite authors and collectors tick, then you'll love hearing what they have to say in our live interviews. Learn how they got started writing, the books and authors that inspired them, what they have in their personal collections, and much more. Meet today's hottest authors as they discuss their life and writing in revealing conversations with our book specialist, Roger Nichols. And find us at modernsignbooks.blogspot.com. Now sit back and enjoy a few minutes with Modern Sign Books. Here's Roger.
Good morning and welcome to Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Roger Nichols. Today we're talking with a man who makes his living with his lips. Barry Campbell is a voice talent, which means he lends his talents to audiobooks, commercials, promotional announcements, and documentaries, among other things. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
These days, all of us are interested in origin stories. Do you always want to be a voice talent, and how did you get in the business?
Well, nice to talk to you, and I took a very typical route to becoming a voice actor. I spent 25 years as a nuclear engineer with the U.S. Navy.
This is, well, work for one of our presidents, but,
yeah. Yeah, I get that a lot. Actually, I worked for the Navy for a long time as in the Navy and then as a civilian, GS working for the Navy and, retired in 2009, found myself old enough to retire and young enough to enjoy it. So I decided, I'd done all the things I ever wanted to do and then some. So I retired and began to do this and that to keep busy. I started to get bored after about a year, and on two separate occasions, two of my friends told me, "Hey, Barry, you've got a nice voice. You really ought to do something with it." And on a whim, one Friday evening, sitting in front of the TV, I fired up my notebook computer and Googled voice acting, and I found the Voice Acting Academy. At the time, I was living in San Diego, and it was about 40 minutes from my house. I phoned them up. It was 8 o'clock at night on Friday night, and they answered anyway. And I started up my first voice acting class the following Tuesday, a beginner's class.
Wow.
And it was like 3 hours a night, one night a week for 8 weeks or 6 weeks. And it was all about what it would take to become a voice actor. And one of the things I learned the very first night was that voice acting is about 10% voice and 90% acting. So that evening I went home and began to think, the reason I'm doing this is because I have a nice voice. I have no idea whether I can act or not, although I've been acting like I knew what I was doing as a nuclear engineer for a long time. So I went back the next week and tried to get my money back, and they wouldn't give it to me. And it turned out after the 6 or 8 week course that I am a fairly good actor, and they were able to teach me the things I needed to know to use my voice as an actor and at least get started in the business.
What was your first gig? What was the first time that you actually got a check for doing this?
I auditioned about 1,000 times, literally, before I landed a gig. And I think it was a radio commercial that a buddy of mine had me do for his tire store. I had a little rudimentary studio set up in my home, so I recorded it. And after doing it, I know that my buddy is an outdoorsman and born and raised in Texas and sort of a cowboyish guy. So after I recorded it straight, I recorded it with sort of a Texas drawl, just to kind of see what it would sound like.
Mm-hmm.
And I presented the original to him, and he liked it. And I said, well, you know, I've got this other one here that I think you might ought to take a look at just to see. It was kind of fun to do. And he liked it way better. So my first gig was doing a radio commercial for a tire store with a Texas drawl. I was born and raised in southern Indiana, which is right close to Louisville, Kentucky. And my whole life I grew up with a southern accent. After I left early 70s, I worked hard on getting it gone and successfully, fairly successfully so, until I go back to Indiana. And then I start saying five and nine and y'all and all the other stuff we say down here.
Do you find yourself, they call it code switching, I guess, in psychology, where you talk different ways to different people. But this is something you have to consciously do when you're acting for a job.
I suppose, yeah. I mean, I'm not a formally trained actor except for the voice acting classes I got. So whenever I act, I sort of use a screen of the mind. I sort of think about what that person would be looking like, the gestures they might have and those kind of things. And that sort of helps me visualize what the person should sound like. So that's kind of how I do that.
Tell me, I have to ask this one too. Tell me when you knew you had made it, that you were going to be able to make a living at it.
Well, I'll let you know when that finally happens.
Okay.
I'm retired from, a good long civilian and military career, and I have a fairly good annuity coming in. So the truth is, I don't really need to make a full-on living as a voice actor. Although I do this quite regularly, I wouldn't say I'm doing this full-time, and I'll definitely say I'm not making enough to make a living doing it.
Oh,
it's a passion for me. It's something that for 30 years thinking with the left side of my brain, drawing straight lines with rulers, the chance to get out of that and to let go a little bit and let the kid come out and to act is just the thing that really makes me keep doing it.
Well, I know that one of the things that you do a great deal of is audiobooks. And how did that come about?
Well, I've been a fan of audiobooks for a long, long time. On my commute to and from work, I always listen to books, and I could listen to a full book in about 2 weeks, and I really began to enjoy that. And I began to develop an ear for the different narrators that I liked, and once in a while one that I didn't like. And what I found was two things. One, I really enjoy the acting part of voice acting. It's sort of like, it's the way I look at it is you can get a really good sense of accomplishment by delivering a 30-second commercial right on, 29 and a half seconds, hit every high note, really deliver the message, make it sound convincing, make it sound natural. It's a very good feeling when that happens. But it's not really acting. In audiobooks, you have to read every word in the book, and in order to do the listener justice, you need to differentiate the voices of the different characters in the book. You get to become every character in the book, the men, the women, the children, the good guys, the bad guys, the people who are excited, the people who are sad, and you're also the narrator, that voice in the sky that ties it all together. And you need to do this pretty much on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with editing as it is, you don't necessarily have to do it all in sequence. You don't necessarily have to do it all at the pace that will come out in the final version. But for the most part, voice actors and audiobook narrators do that. Mm-hmm. They start a chapter at the first word and they end the chapter at the last word. And except for whatever mistakes they might make in reading all the way through, they jump from person to person to narrator to happy to sad, all in step and all in the timing that you hear at the final recording. And that to me is the acting part of voice acting and the part I really love. And one of the reasons that I am concentrating now mostly on audiobooks.
Mm-hmm.
Another big reason is that audiobooks are really up and coming right now. I mean, several years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, there might have been 5,000 books committed to audio in a whole year worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
And now you know, it's $5,000 a month or something, as far as I can tell.
Which is great for somebody who's working in the business. Yes.
Yeah. And with the internet, I don't have to commute to a recording studio. I can set up a fairly professional sounding recording studio in my home, which mm-hmm. I've done. And, I can do all my, all the submitting of the final audio, et cetera, all right over the internet. I don't even have to get out of my pajamas. In fact, I'm talking to you now in my sweatpants, t-shirt, and house slippers, which is how I work every day.
Thank you for that beautiful visual image there. We appreciate it.
I got my feet up and I'm sitting on the couch, so it's a tough life.
Yeah, and you got the big gin Ricky by your side too, I suspect. But one of the things that I am impressed by in listening to your work is how subtle the transition between the narrator and a character is, and yet is still fully convincing. That's some real skill there.
Well, you know, and that's what the professionals have taught me to do. In spite of my desire to go completely overboard, they have taught me to rein it in. there are two sort of schools of audiobook narrating. The first is less is more. Changes in character should be very, very subtle and only just give away the fact that another person is talking, which is what you pointed out. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is that early on, audiobooks were basically only for the visually impaired.
Yeah.
The only people that really listened to audiobooks were people who couldn't read. And the idea was that you don't want to take away from their ability to interpret the words in the book as if they were reading the book. A reader, when he's reading the page, forms his own opinions about what the voice might sound like, what the person might look like, what the scene might look like. That's all part of the wonderful things of reading. And you didn't want to take away that option from the listener, because that's all they were doing. They were just sitting there and listening to that book.
Right.
But of late, it's not that way at all. Most audiobooks are listened to by someone who's doing something else at the same time. And the audiobook is only secondary to that other thing they're doing. They're doing housework. They're driving the car. They're jogging. They're exercising. They're bicycling. Whatever they're doing, the audiobook is in the background. And because of that, they're not devoting nearly as much attention to the book as if they were sitting there and just listening to it by themselves in a quiet room. Because of that, it's important these days to add just a little more, so that the person doesn't have to strain and take their concentration off that first thing in order to keep up with who's talking in a conversation. Because as you know, in a book, it'll say, "Hi, John," said Mary. "Hi, Mary," said John. And then they'll go back and forth, John and Mary, without another said John or said Mary for the next two pages. And if you get lost as to who's talking, you just have to count back up the lines and figure out who said what to whom and then keep on going. Where in an audiobook, you can't do that. You can't count back up the lines. So it's important that all the way through that conversation, it's obvious who's talking. And it needs to be a little more obvious now than it used to be. But if you don't make it subtle, if you try to put too much into it, then the effort put in by the narrator shows through, and it breaks the mystique, it breaks the magic, it breaks the moment for the listener who's listening to the audiobook.
So you're really concentrating on not breaking that fourth wall. You are going to be transparent. You are merely the medium through which the author is speaking.
That's exactly right. The narrator's job is to faithfully put forth the thoughts, the feelings, and the attitudes that the writer put down in the words.
So you have done a number of those. Do you have a favorite?
Well, I've done the first audiobook I did was for a man who became a friend of mine. I have been an avid reader of Clive Cussler since the 70s. He's the if you don't know, his character is Dirk Pitt, and he's like the grandmaster of adventure novels. Many current active authors owe their start listening to Clive Cussler. Anyway, I joined the Clive Cussler Collector Society many years ago. They finally they actually began to have little conventions, 100, 200 person conventions, where Mr. Cussler actually came to the conventions and shook hands and signed books and spoke to us. Cussler was one of the first major authors to employ co-writers. As he got older, he's in his mid-80s now, I believe. As he got older, his publisher wanted him to continue writing, and he wanted to continue writing, but he couldn't keep up with his publisher's demands, and started to hire authors to help him write. And he's done that very successfully, and now many other first-tier novelists have done the same thing. His first co-writer was a fellow named Paul Kimprikos, who, before he began writing with Clive, had authored six sort of regional detective novels that were fairly short, got really good attention where they were located up in the Northeast, but really didn't go nationwide that big. He got a call from Clive. He began writing with Clive, and he showed up at, like, I think our first or second Clive Cussler convention, and I had a chance to meet him and his wife. And over a couple of years, we became very, very good friends. In fact, when I'm in Cape Cod, I stay at his house, and when he's in my neighborhood, he stays at mine. So I was with him one day and realized that none of his first six detective novels had been made into audiobooks. So I got him drunk one night, and I asked him if it might be possible for me, as a budding audiobook narrator, to narrate those books. And, of course, his first question was, what's it going to cost me? My answer was, nothing, not a thing. I'll just take care of everything, and then we'll split the profits if we sell any, 50-50. And that book, Cool Blue Tomb by Paul Kimprikos, hit Audible.com in, I think, October of 2011.
This is from Cool Blue Tomb by Paul Kimprikos. We found a quiet corner of the wharf where we could sit. She glanced around at the fishing boats, the circling gulls, and the camera-toting tourists. Things seem so much different in the daytime, don't they?
And that was my first book. And his novels, I've done six novels of his so far, with a few more to go. And his novels are some of my favorite to do. For two reasons. I like, for many reasons. I like him. I like his characters. But the big reason is that he is such a darn good writer. I have done books that have been written by folks who aren't darn good writers. And, it's my job to read the book, say the dialogue that's written, read the descriptive passages, and make them sound natural and flowing and easy to listen to. When they're not, when the dialogue isn't the way people talk, or when the descriptive language is cumbersome, or in some cases even grammatically incorrect, it makes it very difficult to get those sentences to come out sounding smooth and natural. But with Paul, it's not like that at all. It's just so wonderful, so easy to read those books because of the way they're written.
Wow, that's fantastic. I understand, though, the way of getting a guy drunk to start the relationship is not maybe available to all of us in there.
Well, you know, that's exactly right. My whole life has been a series of fortunate events. there is a Well, Audible.com, which was many years ago bought by Amazon, is sort of the 500-pound gorilla of downloadable audiobooks on the internet. There are many, many other places you can go for downloadable books, but Audible sort of dominates the market. They weren't satisfied with that, and a few years ago, about 2012 or 13, they formed a company or an online presence known as Audiobook Creation Exchange, ACX, which is free for authors and free for narrators, and it tries to hook up authors or rights holders, could be a publisher or a publishing house, with a narrator or producer to put together an audiobook. ACX is available to anyone. The only gotcha is that once you've produced the audiobook, you give Audible exclusive rights to it to download for on their site for 7 years, which is not a bad thing because they are the place people go first for the most part. So for budding narrators out there, or authors or rights holders that have books that haven't been committed to audio yet, ACX is a wonderful place to start.
This is fascinating information. I really appreciate that. He said, scratching his head. I need to shift some gears here and talk a little bit. You mentioned you are a Clive Cussler collector. Besides him, who else is in your library?
Oh, some of my favorites are the Jack Reacher novels by Lee Child.
Yes.
The Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child novels with Pendergast.
Yeah.
Let's see. Harry Potter. I've read the Harry Potter books several times each. And in fact, those audiobooks are some of the best audiobooks going, narrated by Jim Dale, a British stage actor. Jim found himself in the Guinness Book of World Records for creating the most individual voices in a single production with the Order of the Phoenix, I think.
I suspect, because there are a lot of characters there. How do you keep track when you're doing that?
Well, it's fairly easy these days. And I'll just go briefly through how a narrator would mm-hmm. get ready to do a book and then do it. The first thing and the most important thing to do is read the book first.
Yeah.
There are horror stories of narrators who are good sight readers, don't need to pre-read, and can read far enough ahead with their eyes that they can do a very, very good job of delivery. There's a horror story of a young man who did that and was like two-thirds of the way through this novel when the author finally mentioned that the protagonist had a British accent.
Whoops.
Yep, a big whoops. So he had to go back and redo all that stuff. So it is important to read the book front to back to pick up on those little things. The authors rarely describe a character in full on your first meeting. So going through and reading the book and picking up on the character traits mentioned by the author help the narrator to develop the appropriate voice for that character. And it's also kind of important to know who the bad guys are and who the good guys are and what happens in the end so that you don't either give it away at the beginning or you give away enough so that the reader is, that doesn't spoil it for the reader. Mm-hmm. One novel that I did, the antagonist, the bad guy, turned out to be a woman. You didn't find that out until like second to the last chapter. So it was sort of important.
You had to walk a careful line with that.
Absolutely. You can't put too feminine a voice on it, nor too masculine a voice on it. It has to be sort of neutral so that the reader doesn't get too big a hint that the author didn't want them to have. So that's the first thing to do. And making notes about different characters, guys, 6'6" and 250, and he's going to have a pretty deep voice. It might actually say right in the text, his voice sounded like pebbles running down a washboard. So, he's going to have a gravelly sound. And then In other times, it really doesn't say much except perhaps the character's age. Mm-hmm. In one of the books I did for Paul Kimprikos, there was a young man who was very eager. He was young. He was eager. He was very excited most of the time. And it was fairly easy to come up with a voice for him a little bit higher in pitch than the lead character, and always talked a lot faster. And it made it easy to kind of pick that character out of the mix. And then sometimes I'll actually highlight dialogue in a scene where there's three characters, just highlight, you know, the woman in one color and the first man in one color, the second man in another color, just to sort of help, so that I don't have to make too many mistakes and have to go back too many times and change the voice because I didn't see the said Joe at the end of a four sentence line.
How long does it take you to go through? And again, there's no such thing as a typical novel, but some of them are in 250 page range, 300 pages. How long would to go through something like that?
You mean just the prep work or the complete work?
The complete work.
Well, on average, a book is the length of a book in audiobook is gauged in finished hours.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when the book is completely done, edited, and up for sale. If the book is 10 hours long, that's 10 finished hours.
Okay.
And, for me, it takes about 3 or 4 hours per finished hour to do an audiobook. And that's in pre-reading, narrating with mistakes, taking out the mistakes, proofing, and then mastering the audio at the end. So a 10-hour book might take 30 or 40 hours to complete. Some narrators do it quicker. Many narrators do it a lot slower, maybe 6 hours per finished hour.
So do you assemble the master tape together, or do you send them bits and pieces and let them do that?
Usually, well, for ACX, I have to do everything.
Right, right.
The only thing I have ever contracted another person to do is proofing. And that's it's always nice to get a second set of ears, because the eye tends to read what it wants to read. And if you read it that way the first time, the chances are really good you'll read it the same way the second time.
Yeah.
So proofing is almost always something that I like to get somebody else involved in, although I don't always do that. If I'm contracted by a company that produces audiobooks, many times all I have to do is just send them the rough, the first cut. Basically, I record, I go back and take out all my mistakes, and then I send it to them.
Right.
They do take care of mastering and proofing, and they'll send me back a chop sheet of errors that I have to cut in, and then I set those back, and they actually cut them into the audio. So
Sweet. It
both ways.
Okay. So let me switch gears one more time on you, because I understand you have a film career as well.
Yeah, I have had my 15 seconds of fame. I really liked the movie Stargate when it came out. It's been about 25 years ago.
Yeah, great. Yeah.
James Spader and Kurt Russell. James Spader's done pretty good for himself with this new series that he's got on Blacklist.
Mm-hmm.
But I really liked that movie when it came out. And then when I heard that they were thinking of making a TV series out of it, and it was going to star Richard Dean Anderson, MacGyver, whom
yeah.
I always loved watching. I actually purchased Showtime in order to watch that series because it was originally shown on Showtime for about the three seasons. And over the years, it migrated to, I think, the Sci-Fi Channel finally. I moved halfway through their run to from Hawaii to San Diego. With my job for the Navy. And I found out that in San Diego, you could actually drive somewhere else. You could even drive to a different state if you wanted to, which I thought was just incredible after having lived in Hawaii for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So I found out that there was going to be a Stargate convention up in Anaheim, which was only like an hour and 15 minutes from my house. So I got tickets and went up there, and man, it was just a blast. I got a chance to meet some of the stars of the show. I got a chance to see, meet a bunch of great fans. Some of the backstage talent, you know, the producers and that kind of thing. And, they announced at that convention that the next year they were going to hold that same convention, but it was going to be in Vancouver where they actually filmed Stargate, and they were going to offer a set tour. And man, I was just excited. I bought tickets that same day and I was off and running to Vancouver the next year to see the set. It was not disappointing. It was a wonderful tour they gave, and I did something that I thought was good for me, and that because of the job I had, I used to go to the Arctic on nuclear submarines, and I'd been there many times, and whenever we had an opportunity to surface through the ice and get out and walk around, I'd get somebody to take a picture of me. So I had pictures of me standing in front of nuclear submarines surfaced through the ice at the North Pole. So I picked out one, printed up a few copies, and autographed them. So whenever one of the stars or one of the people would autograph a picture of them for me, I would give them an autographed picture of me. And just to kind of, you know, be remembered. I even put my email address on the back. And then, so this one convention, there were three guys on stage, the executive producer and two of the directors, and they are not generally people you want to get autographs from, because they're just, you know, they don't Richard Dean Anderson or Amanda Tapping or one of those. So one of the questions they got was, how come you guys aren't signing autographs? And of course they didn't know, because they were just told by the the convention organizers to get up and answer questions for an hour. So the convention organizer came out and said, well, if you want to, we'll set up a place for them to sign autographs. And they were all willing. So out in the hall, they had a table for them to sign autographs, and I got in line toward the end and walked up to the table, and the executive producer's in the middle, flanked by two directors. And as I want to do, I go right for the top man. Although I was cordial to the two directors, I focused on the executive producer, gave them all one of my pictures. And executive producer says, what's this? And I said, well, that's what I do for a living, go to the North Pole and submarines and stuff. And just to make conversation, I think, he said, do you think you could get me to the North Pole? I've been trying to get there for a long time on one of those Russian icebreaker tours or something like that, and never been able to organize it. And I said, well, you know, Mr. Smith, I don't think I can get you to the North Pole, but I might be able to get you to an ice camp a few hundred miles south of the North Pole. And he almost broke his arm trying to get his business card out of his wallet to give me. Put it up in my face and said, now, if you're serious, you give me a call now. Well, I didn't know if I was serious or not, because I don't make those decisions. But I was going to be the officer in charge of an ice camp coming up in a couple of years, so I have some input. Went back and talked to my boss, and I'll shorten the story a little bit here. Over 2 years, myself and John Smith, the executive producer for Stargate, he on his end and me on my end worked, and we got 18 of his skeleton crew up to my ice camp in 2007. For one full week, and we filmed portions of a movie that came out in 2008 called Stargate Continuum. Mm-hmm. It was a direct-to-DVD movie. You can available at your local Walmart for $4.95 probably. the writer and showrunner, Mr. Brad Wright, was so excited and grateful that for all the work I'd put in to get this to happen, he wrote me 4 lines. Into the movie. And so when the submarine surfaced through the ice, you'll see a sailor up on the bridge sharing the screen with Richard Dean Anderson back and forth, and that sailor was me. The crewman on the bridge, that was me talking to Richard Dean Anderson.
So did you get your Screen Actors Guild card then?
No, I did not, and I almost did. It was a Canadian production, and I could have got a ACTRA card, but I decided not to, and it turned out that was the best idea for me that I could ever do, because if once you're in the union, you do nothing but union work, and audiobooks are mostly not union jobs.
Oh.
So I was prevented from doing some of those. So I'm fortunate that I didn't actually go through with it. Besides, really, it's really expensive to get a SAG card.
I'll bet.
Yeah. And I didn't need, I mean, most people who are in the union, it's so good for them because they get health insurance and pension through the union. But I didn't need any of that stuff, so it really wasn't that important for me.
Okay. So do you own a copy of that movie?
Let's see. Let me count. There's about a half a dozen on my shelf.
Just, DVD just in
and
case.
I'm happy to autograph one and mail it off if you want to.
Oh, well.
I even have my own IMDb page.
Oh, I will definitely be looking you up then. That's absolutely.
Yeah,
with one credit on it. Huh?
With that, I actually got two credits because I actually got my name in the credits. The last one, in fact, the last credit was Crewman on Sale, Barry Campbell. And they actually asked me what I wanted to be called, what was my part, because they didn't have a real name for it in the script. It was just, you know, Crewman. So I put Crewman on Sale to identify me from a couple of the other crewmen that were in it. And then I also got a thank you credit, one of those acknowledgement credits. The credits. Our thanks go out to da-da-da, and I was one of those. So I got two credits in the same movie.
That is fun stuff. Oh, pretty, that's great.
Yeah, that's pretty big time.
Yeah, super. Well, look, you've been very generous with your time with us today. Is there anything about what you do or what you're planning to do next that you'd like to share with us?
Oh, you know, most full-time audiobook narrators will do maybe three or four books a month. That's like a book a week, and that's full time. That's in the studio 8 hours a day, really devoting their life to it. I am retired, and I maybe do a book a month or one every other month. So I'm kind of easing at it. I get to do the books I want to do. I don't have to do any books I don't want to do. I'm working on one now for another one of Clive Cussler's co-authors, a fellow named Graham Brown. He and his brother wrote a book. Actually, this is their second or third book. It's called The Gods of War. It's a sci-fi book, really well written, as typical of the authors that Clive chooses, and a good story. So I'm in the middle of a production of that one right now. But I mean, if you're interested in hearing my voice more than just this blog, you can search for my name, Barry Campbell, on audible.com and come up with 19 or 20 books that I've done.
All right. And we hope that our listeners will absolutely do that, because you have been an absolute gem to talk with. and great stories. And that's the thing that people love, are the great stories. So this is just your first time at the rodeo, as we say in the Eastern Oregon part. Hey, thank you so much for being with us today. And we wish you all the best. And we'll take one of those autographed copies. You betcha.
All right. I'll get in touch with Virginia and figure out how to get it to you.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks for calling.
You've been listening to Modern Sign Books on Blog Talk Radio with book specialist Roger Nichols. Be sure to check us out at modernsignbooks.blogspot.com.